From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is on vacation this week. Arizona's immigration law is creating ripples through the sports world. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at Los Suns and the possibility that Phoenix could lose the 2011 Major League All-Star Game. Also, MLB's haves and have-nots slug it out in baseball's version of Nottingham Forest. And hybrid racing hits a track best known for its NASCAR events. Also, the case for running with liberated toes.
You don't need shoes to run. You can take your shoes off and have a delightful 10, 20, 30-mile run if you'd like to. You can also have a delightful 30-mile run in shoes as well. But when you go without shoes, it teaches you about how your body evolved to run.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is in Italy looking for directions to the nearest Major League Soccer game. Bill's missing out on some baseball news this week, as well as the opportunity to talk with one of his and my favorites, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, who joins me on the line. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. We should begin by acknowledging one of the great voices of baseball. On Tuesday, Ernie Harwell died at the age of 92 after a bout with cancer. His play-by-play career lasted more than half a century, including 42 years with the Detroit Tigers. Tim, what are your memories of Ernie?
Well, he's one of the greatest broadcasters ever. He might be the single nicest person I've ever met in my 30 years of covering baseball. And he was a bit quirky in his own way, which is what made him so great. I remember asking him what memory he was going to take from Tiger Stadium when the great old ballpark closed. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm going to take the urinal from the visitor's clubhouse." And I said, "Ernie, why would you do that?" He said, "Well, every great player in the history of the American League used it. It's a very personal item. I'm going to get it all cleaned up and make it into a planter for my wife." And that is precisely what he did.
Well, in October of 2008, Harwell talked with Only a Game's Doug Trabu about one of his passions outside of baseball.
Well, I'm interested in music. I don't do it anymore, but I wrote country. I wrote rhythm and blues. I wrote ballads. I wrote standard-type songs, and I had about 65 records. But I certainly wasn't giving up my day job. It was just sort of an avocation for me.
I guess the other job worked out all right for you.
It was okay.
Worked out all right for sure. But had you known that Harwell was a Renaissance man?
I did. All you had to do was spend any time with Ernie, and you would realize that he wasn't just your typical baseball nerd like a lot of us. He was part poet. He was part biblical scholar. He was all parts baseball. But there was another side to Ernie that you really had to sit and talk to him to understand that there was a life outside of baseball. But once he put those headphones on and did his work at the ballpark, there wasn't anybody better than Ernie Harwell.
Detroit's had a tough go of it lately. Will the Tigers give Motor City fans something to be happy about this season?
I think they can, Karen. They've brought in some new young players. Austin Jackson, their center fielder, has been terrific. And I think the Tigers have a chance to stay in the race all year. They fell right at the end last year, and they're determined not to allow that to happen again. I think they're a contender all season, and I think that's about all you can hope for.
In the American League East, the Yankees are up to their pinstripes in injuries, and the Red Sox are doing their best impression of the company softball team. Will the Tampa Bay Rays remain on top?
I think the Rays are even better than I thought they would be. I picked them at the beginning of the year to win 92 games and finish third place in the division, and I think I'm going to have to rework that already because They are really good. They are the Phoenix Suns of baseball. They are so athletic. They just run and run and run. They steal bases. They hit home runs. But the difference between them and the Suns is they also play great defense. They have terrific pitching. And, Karen, there is a sense of urgency on that team because everybody knows that their star left fielder, Carl Crawford, is going to leave via free agency after the season, and Carlos Pena might leave after the season also because of free agency. And they all know on that team, if we're going to win it all, we're going to have to do it now. And that's the way they're approaching this entire year.
Minnesota currently sits atop the American League Central. The new domeless home field must be working wonders with the formerly shut-in Twins.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful ballpark, and it's obviously so much nicer than the indoor Metrodome, which was quirky and funny and the loudest building I've ever been in. But the people in Minnesota were dying to get outside, and they've got a beautiful place to go. And I think it would be very appropriate if they christened that new stadium with another division title, which at this point I think is going to happen. A lot of things have gone right for the Twins so far, and that their ballpark is just sensational, one of the great new ballparks that we've seen in the last few years.
On Wednesday, flame-throwing pitcher and 2009 top draft pick Steven Strasburg was called up to the Washington Nationals AAA team. He's expected to make his big league debut in early June. Will it be spectacular?
Karen, I think he will be. I saw him in spring training. I am going to see him pitch next week in Syracuse on the day I go pick up my daughter from college at Syracuse. How perfect is that?
Perfect.
He's got spectacular stuff. When he does show up in the first week of June, he's going to have a decent defense behind him, which they didn't have last year, and a pretty good bullpen behind him also, which they didn't have last year. So it's almost like the whole team is being built for his arrival, because when he arrives, it's going to be a spectacle in Washington, and that's great because the people here haven't had a whole lot to cheer about for a few years.
And finally, Tim, lawmakers recently honored soon-to-be-retired Atlanta manager Bobby Cox on Capitol Hill. But someone misspelled his name on the cake, although it was phonetically correct, if you catch my drift. Cox deserved better than this for his half-century or so in the game, didn't he?
Yes. Now, fortunately, Bobby Cox doesn't take himself too seriously. He never has. So he had a hearty laugh about that because I'm sure he's run into unfortunate things before. But having said that, we're talking about statistically one of the five greatest managers of all time. Someday historians are going to look back at what the Braves did with Bobby Cox winning 14 division titles in a row, and they're going to slap their forehead and said, how could that have possibly happened during the free agent era where players are moving around? Someday people are going to understand how great a manager Bobby Cox is. Fortunately, I think I understand that right now as he's still managing his final year in the major leagues.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN, and he joins Only a Game from time to time to talk about diamond matters. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Karen.
Over the past decade, the divide has grown between baseball's haves, the Yankees, Red Sox, Cubs, and Dodgers spring to mind, and have-nots, the teams that play in considerably smaller markets. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, a growing chorus is charging that those have-nots could be doing more to field winning teams.
It may sound ridiculous to talk about a poverty line in the highly salaried precincts of Major League Baseball, but for almost 15 years, baseball has run its own version of a welfare program in which the well-heeled teams share the wealth with their needier counterparts. Jason Stark, ESPN.com senior baseball writer, estimates that the revenue-sharing pot has grown to nearly $500 million. But he adds, since some recipients of that largesse spent under $50 million on player salaries last season, the richer owners have begun to question where all their money is going.
More and more you're hearing from the teams at the top of the charts, the Yankees and the Red Sox in particular have been the most vocal, that they don't believe that the teams at the bottom are spending this money on their big league teams. They think they're spending it on their stadiums. They think they're spending it to pay off debt. They think they're spending it on the office Christmas party. And that's an increasing source of tension in the sport.
Last winter, Red Sox principal owner John Henry complained that baseball's revenue-sharing program has channeled over $1 billion to what he called seven chronically uncompetitive teams, five of whom have baseball's highest operating profits. Stark adds that besides receiving multi-million dollar subsidies, the teams living below baseball's poverty line get an equal $30 million a year cut from baseball's national TV contract, and at least $15 million more from local TV. Stark recently crunched the numbers and found that baseball's dozen or so have-nots have a lot more than many people think.
The Marlins, the Pirates, the Rays, the Blue Jays, and the Royals averaged $35 million, probably a little more than that, in revenue sharing. I've documented that at least 10 teams in the sport collect $80 million before they sell a single ticket or a single slice of pizza.
According to Forbes magazine, the Marlins, who spent under $37 million in players' salaries last year, led the majors in operating income with $46 million. Instead of paying the escalating salaries of pitchers Josh Beckett and A.J. Burnett and sluggers Derek Lee and Miguel Cabrera in recent years, Florida has gotten rid of them. This past winter, the Marlins agreed to the demands of the commissioner's office and the players' union to spend more on players' salaries. Miami Herald beat reporter Clark Spencer notes that the team promptly signed staff ace Josh Johnson to a $39 million four-year extension.
I think they got their hand caught in the cookie jar with the revenue-sharing money, and that's why they were forced to come out with this agreement. And it was also, I think, a warning to some of the low-spending teams, like the Pirates, for example, that look what we did to the Marlins, and now you guys need to get in shape and start spending money as well, start spending this revenue-sharing money.
The Pirates don't even have the luxury of a winning record. They've had 17 straight losing seasons, the longest skein of futility in any major sport. The fact that the continually profitable franchise is spending only $35 million on this season's roster hasn't helped matters. Dan Kovacovic covers the team for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
There's just a general distrust of the Pirates, particularly of the ownership and their willingness, not so much ability, but willingness to spend. There are people who would prefer to see the Pirates immediately and into the future prioritize winning over profits.
Pirates president Frank Coonerly insists that his team is making good use of its subsidies, even if it's not apparent.
The Pittsburgh Pirates last year, we spent almost $10 million in the amateur draft and signing bonus to amateur players. Then you have the cost of your entire minor league system. Each club has at least 7 to 8 to 9 minor league teams. We build a brand new baseball academy and dormitory in the Dominican Republic. I said that we need to become leaders again in Latin America, and we've spent over $5 million building a brand new facility, top of the industry facility, that will allow us to continue to bring players through Pittsburgh.
Ideas for improving the current system have begun to proliferate. While some in the players' union favor imposing a minimum payroll level, Boston Red Sox owner John Henry has suggested taxing team payrolls more uniformly to raise revenue-sharing funds. And ESPN.com's Jason Stark advocates a tax on teams falling short of a minimum payroll number as an incentive to get them spending more. Those proposals may gain traction as baseball's collective bargaining agreement comes up for renewal at the end of next year. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Video games have come a long way since Roger Clemens' MVP Baseball in the early 90s boasted a MIDI soundtrack and the ability to save games. Major League Baseball 2K10 was released in January with slick graphics, an innovative pitching interface, and a $1 million prize to the first person to pitch a perfect game. Wade McGilbury of Mobile, Alabama, bought the game at midnight on the night of its release, but his wife Katie encouraged him to go to work the next day. The $1 million prize be damned. Despite putting in a full day at the office, Wade came home at 4 in the afternoon, sat down, and won $1 million, just 90 minutes after picking up the controller. In the months since, Wade has never come close to repeating his feat. He says there must have been something special about that day. I'm Karen Given in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, hybrid auto racing gets the green light. But first, in last night's Stanley Cup playoff action, the Philadelphia Flyers edged the Boston Bruins 5-4 in overtime to avoid the sweep. And Chicago Blackhawks team captain Jonathan Toews scored a hat trick and two assists to lead his team to a 7-4 victory over the Vancouver Canucks. Chicago could win that series at home on Sunday. In the NBA, the Cleveland Cavaliers topped the Boston Celtics 124-95 to take that series to 2-1, and the Phoenix Suns beat the San Antonio Spurs 110-96 to take a 3-0 lead. Last night, the Suns were once again simply the Suns after briefly appearing as Los Suns for Game 2. Phoenix owner Robert Sarver asked his team to wear their Los Suns jerseys on Wednesday in honor of Cinco de Mayo and in protest of Arizona's new immigration law. Joining me on the line is Arizona Republic columnist Dan Bickley. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure, Karen.
You wrote this week that Sarver deserved credit for asking his team if they would wear the jerseys. Are you surprised that the team voted unanimously to wear them or that they were so vocal against the immigration law?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure that any other team in the NBA might have reacted the same way. I think a lot of guys would tend to be apolitical or maybe just practice what I like to call the politics of richness. Mm-hmm. What the Suns do, though, is they really follow the cue of their point guard, Steve Nash and Grant Hill, who are two guys who tend to be opinionated on issues that concern us all, whether it's global warming or gun control or immigration. So I think anybody would know, if you knew the Suns and their makeup, that they'd be willing to do this, that they'd be willing to step out and say, no, we don't like this law. We don't like the idea that it allows or could afford racial profiling and do it as vociferously as they did. But it's kind of unique to have an owner step out and voluntarily anger part of his consumer base and then have his team so readily embrace what that message is, yes.
Well, about that anger, one fan told your paper that she shredded her four lower-level tickets to Wednesday's game in protest.
Yeah.
And 79 of the 84 letters to the editor sent into the Republic opposed Sarver's decision. Have the Suns alienated their fans?
Yes, they have alienated some fans, and there's a lot of people who have been negatively affected by illegal immigration in Arizona. It's been a hot-button topic for a long time. But what I think you're also getting, Karen, is you're just getting a lot of people who are very vocal about this who really aren't basketball fans, because I don't buy for a minute that any true Suns fan in Arizona is going to rip up their tickets or suddenly denounce their basketball team when they could be on the precipice of one of their, you know, greatest series victories. I just don't buy that.
The NBA has opposed other political statements around the league, like when LeBron James and others criticized China's role in Darfur. But Commissioner Stern issued a statement saying that he felt the Suns' move was appropriate. Why is this particular political statement okay with the NBA?
Now, you know, that's a great question, and it kind of shows the hypocrisy of the league, but yet they're very consistent in what they care about, and they care about global markets, and they care about money, and that is what their politics are steeped in. LeBron James and others really made it clear that they were going to take a firm stand against China, against their human rights record. And I was literally in a room with the assistant commissioner of the NBA who literally told our Olympic team, listen, you all, whether you know it or not, you all have financial interests in China. And if you speak up, you're going to make them mad. And if you make them mad in their own country and you embarrass them in their own country, you are going to pay for it economically. And from that point forward, the light bulb went on and they suddenly began talking in terms of, sports and politics, it doesn't mix. We have no business standing out for issues. And now here in Phoenix, you've got the complete polar opposite reaction. You've got the NBA encouraging this kind of behavior, but they're doing it because they want to protect and grow their Latino market.
The Suns already had the Los Suns jerseys in their closet from the NBA's Noche Latina celebration in March. 10 teams were issued Latino-themed jerseys for that promotion. Do you expect to see Los Lakers or El Magic taking the court during this postseason?
The way that the consumer base in Phoenix has reacted, and like you said, you've seen some of the dissenting opinions and the people who think the Suns have no business stepping inside this political arena. I don't really see the NBA furthering this. I would really be surprised if they went out of their way now to wear and showcase any more of those Latino jerseys that they have.
Dan, almost a third of all Major League Baseball players are Hispanic, and players have joined online organizations in pressuring the MLB to move the 2011 All-Star Game from Phoenix to another site if the immigration law is not repealed. Do you expect Major League Baseball to take a stand on this issue?
You know, that is, in Arizona, that is the million-dollar question, probably about a $10 million question, and it's obviously got a lot of politicians nervous. The other day, Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, wrote an essay for ESPN.com. It was a very strange platform for the governor of Arizona. I think Major League Baseball does not want to take away the All-Star Game. They will if they have to. I think the Diamondbacks are really afraid of that happening because they've been trying to sell tickets based on the fact that, hey, you sign up and buy tickets with us. We've got the All-Star Game coming. It's a mess. It really, really is a mess, and it's unbelievable to see this intersection of sports and politics and tempers. It's made for a very strange playoff season in Phoenix.
Dan Bickley is a sports columnist for the Arizona Republic. Dan, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Karen.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your Priuses. Or is that your Prii? Anyway, engineering students from around the world gathered in Loudoun, New Hampshire this week to see how the hybrid race cars they designed stack up. Only a Game's Doug Tribou has the story.
The New Hampshire Motor Speedway hosts two NASCAR Sprint Cup events each season and can hold more than 95,000 fans. But today, the massive aluminum grandstands are empty. It's Wednesday, day three of the Formula Hybrid International Competition, and the roar of stock cars has been replaced with this.
All right, Wisconsin, we're in the line. I like the building. Curtis?
Okay, to be fair, that was an electric-only run. When it's time to hit the gas in these open-wheeled, Indy-style hybrids, some of them sound like this. This year's competition has attracted more than two dozen teams from the U.S., Canada, Italy, and Russia. A team from Taiwan is here, too, but their vehicle is still in New York because of a customs problem. This morning, the teams are doing acceleration runs on what normally serves as pit row. One by one, students drive as fast as they can down a straight 75-meter strip. There are electric-only runs and unrestricted runs in which gasoline use is allowed. The day's fastest times are just under 5 seconds. University of Wisconsin team member James McFarland says when you finally get behind the wheel after months of working on a car, there's hardly time to let the surroundings sink in.
There's no real extra time to think about, you know, how cool this is. And now that I step back and think about it, it's really cool that I just got to drive a car on, you know, professional racetrack. And the surface is so much better than anything I've ever driven on before. And the tires just stick really nice. And,
but when you're in there, you're thinking about making this thing that you've been working
on. It's definitely total tunnel vision. Clutch, shift, brake, gas, feather the clutch.
The Society of Automotive Engineers, now known as SAE International, started holding competitions for student-designed and built Formula race cars in 1979. Doug Fraser is the director of the Formula Hybrid Project at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Fraser says in 2006, some Dartmouth students built a gasoline-electric hybrid, but SAE International wouldn't allow it in the regular competition, so Dartmouth created its own event.
We did it just as a demonstration event out here in a parking lot 5 years ago, and it was so well-received that we just decided to try to formalize it, wrote up a set of rules, created a rules committee. The SAE got on board, and so we are now a member of the Collegiate Design Series, which is a number of competitions worldwide, actually.
McGill University has been part of the event since the first demonstration in 2006. The team's car is a series hybrid, meaning it has a built-in gas-powered generator, but the motors run entirely on electricity. Joey Oddman is the team captain. He says driving a quiet race car takes some getting used to.
We're from Montreal, and we have the F1, and they have the Grand Prix there, and that's just ridiculous. I mean, you have to have headphones in to even be near the cars, whereas us, you can walk around and listen to your iPod, and the iPod's louder than the car running, so it's very different.
To be allowed on the track, each team has to undergo a rigorous set of safety inspections. Hybrid systems operate on potentially lethal voltages, so there's an electrical inspection. there's also a brake check and a tilt test to check for center of gravity and leaks. The teams are judged in six categories, including design and team presentations about the vehicles. Tomorrow, there's a 22-kilometer endurance run with a set amount of fuel. Run out of fuel and you don't finish. Finish with something left in the tank and you could have gone faster. This afternoon, the cars are weaving between cones on a banked portion of the track. Texas A&M's production manager, Sam Craven, says the autocross course tests handling, acceleration, and braking.
So when you have a course like this, this is kind of a, yeah, what our professor said, when the green flag drops, the bull stops. So this is the chance for all the teams that, you know, may have a good-looking car, may have a really great design. This is the chance to kind of be like, okay, well, it actually works, or that's an awful idea, so...
Building a Formula Hybrid race car can cost up to $30,000, and students often have to find funding on their own. While the cars cost a lot, New Hampshire Motor Speedway provides its services free of charge. Speaking during a press conference, Speedway General Manager Jerry Gappens says the racing community is always looking for new technologies, so hosting the competition seemed like a perfect fit.
The day of being a shade tree mechanic are over. I remember as a boy, my dad would throw a hoist up on a tree limb. He could pull an engine out of a car. We'd fix it right there under the tree or in a one- or two-car garage. Today, with the technology advances that have been made, NASCAR teams are hiring specialized engineers.
Formula Hybrid Project Deputy Director Winnie Washburn says having the competition on a professional track makes all the difference.
Amazing. This is amazing. This is a NASCAR speedway. I mean, and here we are, like, in the garages, like we're NASCAR people, but they're students.
Mario Chiara DeVasco captains the team from Politecnico di Torino in Italy. He says all the teams want to win, but there's a spirit of cooperation.
I mean, here we are all people from university, students, some teachers. So we like to share around tools and materials. And we also got a lot of materials from other teams. Let's say Drexel, they gave us some spare materials, some tools. They're also giving us some t-shirts from their university. So that's pretty cool. It's a good collaboration.
San Jose State University senior Matt Kilthow and his teammates spent a lot of time talking with other teams and checking out their cars. What feature caught Kilthow's attention? Maybe a capacitor or front-wheel electric motor. Oh, come on. These are race cars, after all.
The Italian car has a lot of fancy gadgets on it, I guess, like steering wheel displays. And we'll see if they perform any better with that stuff. But, you know, it's not necessarily going to make them faster, but it's pretty cool.
Doug Fraser says Formula Hybrid generates a lot of excitement on the track. But the most exciting aspect may be innovations that could be used beyond the speedway.
We actually have two teams that have registered that have applied for patents on their hybrid drive architectures. And this was more than we dared hope for. We'd set this up. This is an educational program. It's to get mechanical, electrical engineers working together, collaborating on a project, you know, following it through to completion. And we hadn't really hoped that the solution to the world's energy problems would pop out of a student design, but it might.
In the end, the Formula Hybrid competition was a proverbial photo finish. Politecnico di Torino topped defending champ Texas A&M by just 3.4 points out of a possible 1,000. No word on whether Politecnico's fancy steering displays were the difference. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
To see Doug Tribou's photos from the Formula Hybrid International Competition, visit our website, onlyagame.org. On the speedway, on the speedway, on the speedway,
on the speedway, on the speedway, on the speedway.
You're listening to Only a Game. Today in Rome, Yelena Yankovic will face Maria Martinez Sanchez in the finals of the WTA Italian Open. This is usually the kind of tournament we ignore here at Only a Game, except when we have a chance to talk to an expert who knows more than all others. You know, someone who's really, really clued in to the tennis scene, and that would be none other than our very own Bill Littlefield. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Karen.
You attended the Italian Open the other day in the company of the true expert on all things tennis, the Boston Globe's Bud Collins. So here's the most important question. What was Bud wearing?
Bud was wearing an exceptionally conservative pair of pinstripe trousers. However, a fantastic pair of his very most flamboyant trousers was hanging in an exhibition at the Foro Italico, where the Italian tournament, what they now call the Rome Masters Tournament, was in session. So he was well represented, as were his pants.
Serena Williams lost in the semifinal of her first venture back from a long layoff for a knee injury. She conceded earlier that she had been rusty earlier in the week and promised that the sexy Serena would be back for the semis. I know you're biased, so I have to ask, was Serena already sexy despite the rust?
Well, you know, she told me some time ago that she couldn't imagine anybody being more sexy and didn't understand why she didn't always get center court at Wimbledon. But she was a little less energized than she should have been at several points in that semifinal match when it looked as if she could have put it away, and she just couldn't find the energy she needed to do that.
The Rome Masters is one of those tournaments Americans tend not to notice. How do the Italians embrace their hometown tourney?
I think they embrace the men's side of the tournament with great enthusiasm. I'm told by Bud Collins that the place was packed for the men's tournament. But as you know, the women's tournament follows the men's tournament. They don't do them simultaneously. And the women's tournament was very poorly attended. A lot of empty seats.
Last question, Bill. Any chance you want to stay on vacation another week? Because I'm having a lot of fun here.
Well, I've had the manicotti. I've had the fettuccine. I've had the spaghetti. I'm almost finished here. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to come back to work.
Oh, bummer. Bill Littlefield is, well, you know who Bill Littlefield is. Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thank you, Karen. Take care.
Don't know what you're cooking, do you? Hey, mambo. Mambo Italiano. Hey, mambo. Mambo Italiano, ho, ho, ho. You mixed up a Siciliano. Hello, Kissadigi. You get happy in the pizza when you mambo Italiano.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Love you.
What's in a name? Well, if you're Tim Tebow, one of the newest members of the Denver Broncos, apparently quite a lot. ESPN.com asked readers this week to give a new moniker to the Heisman Trophy winner with a squeaky clean reputation. The fan favorite? The Mile High Messiah. But some of the runners-up are also noteworthy. T-Bench is the nickname given by fans convinced Tebow's skills won't translate to the pros. Clipboard is another along that vein. The Big Tabowski and Tebowlicious have been suggested by fans with slightly higher expectations. And my personal favorite, the Unicorn, submitted by a fan in Ontario who believes, quote, only women and defensive ends of pure virtue will be able to touch him. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the author of Born to Run strips off his shoes and mine. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from Oxford, Mississippi for a look at the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Do I want to know about this shoe taking off thing or don't I?
Probably not.
Excellent. Let's move on then.
The Philadelphia Phillies have decided that team security and not Philadelphia police officers will handle most unruly fans after 17-year-old Stephen Consalve was tased for running onto the field on Monday. But some players and team officials say the tasing wasn't out of line. After all, a fan beat Royals first base coach Tom Gamboa in 2002. Which side of the tase line do you come down on?
This is disgusting, and the fact that it's being reacted to with such almost universal approval makes me sick to my stomach. This was torture, pure and simple. This guy didn't get tased because he was a threat to anybody. He got tased because the cop couldn't catch him. there's enough of this nonsense going around the country right now. There are at least 12 deaths that have been attributed one way or another to something that was supposed to be a use of non-lethal force. And the overall acceptance of this thing makes me weep for my nation, frankly.
Okay, Charlie, most baseball teams would see an over 500 start as mediocre at best. But for one National League team, it's their best start since moving to a new city in 2005. And that team would be?
That would be your Washington Nationals, the baseball team which various Beltway sycophants decided we had to have in our nation's capital. And there are a few games over 500 delighting their dozens of fans.
Hundreds of fans paid their last respects to broadcaster Ernie Harwell on Thursday. Harwell died Tuesday at the age of 92. Do you have a favorite Ernie Harwell story to share?
Well, I have two, actually. First of all, he was the voice of Tiger Stadium, which was absolutely my favorite ballpark of all time. But I remember going there to cover a big series once when I was writing for the Boston Herald, and I got there a day early, and I went to the ballpark, and I sat outside on the sidewalk with about 50 or 60 or 100 other people and listened to Ernie Harwell's broadcast on the loudspeakers outside the stadium, which I thought was probably tribute enough to how good he was.
Danny Ainge, the Boston Celtics president of basketball operations, was fined $25,000 on Thursday for waving a white towel over his head during the third quarter of Monday night's playoff game against Cleveland. What was Ainge trying to do? Surrender to King James?
No, he was distracting a free throw shooter like he was 12 years old again or something and at his high school game. That's a very expensive towel waving, though, I have to admit. That may be the all-time NBA record fine for towel waving.
Montreal just eked into the final playoff spot in the NHL's Eastern Conference, and the Canadiens have been taken lightly for much of the season. But I guess you can now count the defending Stanley Cup champion Pittsburgh Penguins among those who now fear the Blue, Blanc, and Rouge.
Well, a little bit. I mean, Montreal won a game in Pittsburgh and then promptly gave the home ice advantage back to Pittsburgh by losing its first game in Montreal. Now they're even in the series. They're playing much better, of course, in the postseason than they ever did in the regular season. And if it weren't for the march of the Boston Bruins, it'd be the biggest story in the league.
On Thursday, NFL Hall of Famer Lawrence Taylor was charged with third-degree rape involving a minor. Taylor is considered by many to be the greatest defensive player in the history of the league. He's been retired for a long time, but this still isn't the kind of press Commissioner Goodell is looking for.
No, it's not the kind of press Western civilization is looking for, let alone the tiny little world of the NFL. Well, I think Lawrence has been, you know, he's been a lot of trouble waiting to happen for a long time, but he's been relatively quiet recently. And this story is an almost bottomless lagoon of ickiness.
The Oakland Raiders have released Jamarcus Russell, who just 3 years ago was the number one pick in the draft. In that time, he made more than $38 million while contributing to only 7 wins as a starter. How does he rank on the list of all-time draft busts?
Well, he's below certainly Ryan Leaf, who was not only an incredible bust, but an unpleasant human being. I haven't heard anything bad about Jamarcus Russell, the person, but I mean, this is what happens when your professional football franchises continue to be owned and operated by an elderly maniac.
A debate is raging in the collegiate golf world, Charlie. A University of St. Francis golfer named Grant Wybark intentionally double bogeyed a playoff hole to allow his rival to qualify for the NAIA National Championship. Wybark was already qualified to attend because of his team's performance. Had he won the hole, there would have been no individual qualifier. So, selfless act or dirty, underhanded favoritism?
In basketball, they call this throwing the game. In baseball, this gets you banned for life. International fencing had a problem very similar to this that almost destroyed the sport about 20 years ago. This is not a selfless act. This is cheating the game, cheating the other players, and cheating yourself.
Since returning to international competition in 1992, South Africa's national soccer team has averaged just 1.1 goals per game. South Africans don't want to be embarrassed on their home pitch in this summer's World Cup, so players are being told they'll share 1 million rand for every goal they make in the tournament. Any guesses as to what their new goal average will be?
Well, 1.1 goal per game. I'd say the South African Soccer Federation is making a very wise investment here in offering this bonus. I think that sooner or later you will see a $2 million rand game from the South Africans, probably against the United States.
And finally, Charlie, you might as well start shouting sports now. 1,722 men, women, and children set a new world record in Brixham last weekend for the largest gathering of pirates.
Sports! Arrgh!
Do you have a word of congratulations to offer?
Shiver their timbers, every damn one of them.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and joins Bill Littlefield at this time each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
We are singing pirates, we're all in o'er the seas. We are singing pirates and we do just what we please. If you seize them jolly boots, we're coming after you. When all looks lost, you still have a shot. Join me, mateys, in the crew. So grab your sword and climb aboard. Join Captain Bog on the Pollywog with me, mateys, in the crew.
The recreational running craze took off in the 70s with the mantra, all you need to run is a shirt, shorts, and a pair of shoes. But those shoes have become more and more complicated over the past few decades. A commercial for a popular sporting goods store reminds shoppers that May is National Running Month and poses the question.
You need anything?
Brooks Adrenal and GTS!
Asics, Gel Kayano!
Modern running shoes generally cost between $80 and $200, but a movement is sweeping through the running community, suggesting that not only do we not need more and more expensive running shoes, we might not need shoes at all. Which is how, at 7 in the morning, 2 days before the Boston Marathon, while city workers erect barricades along the race route, a small revolution is taking place inside a downtown sporting goods store. Runners like Alice Jenny from Houston, Texas, slowed by foot and leg injuries, say they're no longer afraid to run barefoot.
No, I will do it in a heartbeat because I'm a runner and that's what I do. And I'm at the point where what I'm doing now isn't working for me. And so I've read about barefoot running and I started reading the book, Born to Run.
For the past year, Christopher McDougall, the author of Born to Run, has appeared on talk shows and crisscrossed the country for book signings, usually in his bare feet. Today, he plops those feet atop a bench in front of thousands of dollars worth of the best Nike, Adidas, and Saucony has to offer, preaching against wearing shoes.
ASICS now has a shoe which is responsive to women's menstrual cycles.
Sounds like BS.
Doesn't it? You know, if you want to sell something, if you want to have the greatest marketing tool of all time, that's fear.
McDougall's fear came from something called cuboid syndrome. His doctors told him he's too tall, too broad, and too solid to run. Picture the guy who played the mummy in those Brendan Fraser movies. Now a few pounds lighter, McDougall still looks like he could fit Ethiopian distance runner Haile Gebrselassie in his back pocket. But he says he hasn't had a single running injury since he stopped wearing traditional running shoes. McDougall didn't invent barefoot running, but like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he brought it to the masses.
Well, you know, we've hit a critical juncture where so many people have been hurt for so long that they're desperate, and what they've been told doesn't work. All this crap on the wall doesn't do anything. It doesn't help. They're obsessed because they want to be able to run around and not get hurt anymore.
Born to Run is the de facto Bible for a new generation of barefoot runners. But on the front cover, ultramarathoner Billy Barnett stands in silhouette, high atop a mountain in Mexico. And Billy is wearing shoes. Only a single chapter, just 16 of the 287-page tale of adventure, biology, physics, evolution, and ultramarathon history actually addresses running shoes and why we might not need them. McDougall says he didn't know those 16 pages would fuel a movement.
No idea. Matter of fact, I almost cut that chapter about the shoes out of the book because when you start to get immersed in this kind of stuff, after a while, you just sort of take it for granted everybody knows this. And, because it's so logical and makes such perfect sense when you try it for yourself.
Corrado Giambalvo from Rome, Italy, is a product tester for Vibram Five Fingers, a company that produces a minimalist running shoe that looks like a cross between a slipper and a glove. He's run two marathons completely barefoot, and today he led a barefoot running clinic through Boston Common.
It's funny, we were running in the park, and there was one guy wearing shoes who was jogging with his girlfriend, I think, and he said, hey, don't worry, I'm a convert, as if to reassure us that even though he was wearing shoes, he was into this minimalist and barefooting thing. And I said, dude, we're not a cult. I mean, we're not trying to convert anybody, okay?
But not everyone is convinced.
I'm just not buying it. I'm simply not buying it for right now.
Kevin Kilbride is a marathoner from Santa Monica, California. He's in Boston to run the marathon, injured, but he's not swayed by Christopher McDougall's pitch.
I mean, it was a book. I picked up the book, and within three pages, I knew the bias. I knew what the bias was. I knew where he was going with it. And he's a damn good writer, and I'll finish the book, but I really think it's crap.
You're going to keep your shoes on.
Damn right, man.
Two days later, most marathon runners passing through the sleepy town of Newton are wearing shoes. Precious few wear minimalist running shoes or go completely barefoot. Robert Forster, a California physical therapist who's brought everyone from Jackie Joyner Kersee to Pete Sampras back from injury, points out that none of the winners are without shoes.
No. And I was at the New York Marathon this year. I was at the LA Marathon. I saw a handful of barefoot runners. And let me remind my colleagues in barefoot running that none of the elite Kenyans were barefoot in the races I saw. So presumably they switched from barefoot to shoes for a reason.
Barefoot running enthusiasts point to runners from Kenya's Rift Valley and a small tribe in Mexico's Copper Canyon as proof that people can run successfully for very long distances without shoes. But Forster says there's no reason those successes apply to you and me.
They need to remember that those folks have been running or walking barefoot since they were little kids. To take, first of all, a tenderfoot, if we can call it that, is, first of all, without the calluses, we're going to find, you know, problems with blisters and cuts and abrasions. Above and beyond that, I do think your skin will toughen up. But have the joints of your feet, which have been babied by wearing shoes for your whole life, you know, are they ready for the forces of barefoot running?
Forster says even with a proper running technique, modern running shoes are still needed for the most common running problem, overpronation. In the past 30 years, Forster says he's seen injuries decrease as running shoes get better and better. Dan Lieberman, professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University, says that's hogwash.
So far, nobody, myself included, has done an injury study. So nobody's ever done a study which shows that your shoes prevent you from getting injured. The flip side of that is nobody's ever done a study showing that not wearing shoes prevents you from getting injured either. So right now we're operating in an absence of information.
What Lieberman has studied and has been studying for years is how humans, about 2 million years ago, evolved to become the best long-distance runners in the mammalian world. Lieberman says we have features from our heads to our toes that are designed specifically for running. And some of those features seem to work best when we're barefoot. Lieberman says barefoot running is less impactful than the typical heel strike most of us do in shoes, and he says he can prove it.
This is the hardest treadmill in the world, which will prove to you that you can run on the hardest surfaces in the world with no impact.
Okay.
Let's see if you do it right. So Adam, why don't you get her up to a walking speed?
Lieberman strips me of my shoes and puts me on a treadmill fitted with a force plate and attached to a computer. Turns out, I'm a perfect test subject.
Every time her body hits the ground, she's making a loud noise, right? That's the collision of her body hitting the ground.
Lieberman shows me a graph of my short run. When my heel hits the ground, about 2 times my body weight slams back up my leg in just 1/10 of a second. Lieberman compares it to taking a hammer and hitting myself on the heel. No wonder I like my cushy-soled, pronation-correcting running shoes. A quick lesson in barefoot running technique, and I'm back on the treadmill.
Great job! See how much quieter that is?
Not only is it quieter, but this time the graph looks like rolling hills instead of large spikes. But Lieberman cautions, before I can become a true barefoot runner, I need to build up strength in my feet and my calves, and that needs to be done over time.
I would say don't do more than a mile at first. You know, if you decide to go run 5 miles tomorrow barefoot, you will curse the day you ever tried it, right? You'll be unhappy, you'll be in pain, you'll be in agony, you'll be limping around. It will not be fun.
The next day, I strap on my 5 fingers and set out on my first barefoot-style run. And I like it. Instead of hearing the slap-slap of my feet over the music in my iPod, I take the buds out of my ears and enjoy the sounds of the birds in the trees and the geese on the water. The only discomfort comes from a blister on my big toe. Maybe next time I go for a run, I'll put on my pronation-correcting shoes. Or maybe I'll go barefoot. Lieberman says the point of the barefoot movement isn't to tell people what they should or should not put on their feet. It's merely to tell us that we have the choice.
I think there's a general trend. I mean, you're going to see more and more minimal shoes out there in the market. And it doesn't mean you have to be like all this or all that. I mean, you can wear your high-heeled shoe on Tuesday, and you can wear your minimal shoe on Thursday, and you can go barefoot on Saturday. You can do what you want, and I think that's good for people.
Took off a wig and higher sneakers too. She did the dance without any shoes. She was well,
Game is produced by Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray, to whom we bid a fond adieu. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To watch as Dan Lieberman tries to teach me to run barefoot, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archive shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from barefoot runner Dan Lieberman.
If you want to try to barefoot run, go somewhere that's nice and smooth. It's rough that hurts.
Note to self, keep unshod feet clear of asphalt, gravel, broken glass, and acorns. Huh, hadn't thought of that before. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org, and Ann and John Herman, supporting the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR.